believers here in Saugus. We welcome each of you to this weekend and to this first meeting. We're grateful you've come. And for the speakers, I can say we're very grateful we were asked to come and are delighted to be here. Let me just lay out the day and the weekend for you. Today, starting at 10 a.m., which was 15 minutes ago, we began our first meeting. This meeting will go on for 2.5 hours, which sounds like an awfully long stretch, but 15 minutes are already over of that 2.5 hours, so that's one good thing. Another is that we will have two breaks, a brief one when I'm finished speaking here, and then we'll divide the remaining time up into two, and we'll give you a generous maybe 10 or even 11 minutes of break so that you can stretch and leave the auditorium and come back refreshed. This meeting then will go on until 12:30. We'll have a buffet lunch in between. That's perhaps a very dismissive way of talking of some very good food I know they have prepared for us, but anyway, that's how it will be served. And then at 2 o'clock, we'll have the next meeting. And if that's what you realize right now, that's enough. You don't need to know any more than that. At 2 o'clock, we'll tell you what happens later, although I can give you a sneak preview that there will be a gospel meeting at 4:45. Now, the purpose of this morning's talk, if I can call it that, is to kind of lay the foundation for the weekend. And we have chosen three topics that we would call Christian apologetics. Apologetics is one of those Janus words, we call them, which means one thing and it means the opposite at the same time. Okay? It's like a cleaving in the Bible. Does cleave mean to split wood in two? Or does it mean to join together? Well, the answer is it means both, and you have to decide which one in context. So, apology, normally we think of that as saying, I'm sorry, I offended you, I did something wrong, I'm embarrassed, this is something that should never have come about, and therefore I apologize to you, I'm sorry, if you want, I'll grovel in the dirt before you and do some penance. That's, I'm just trying to create the ambiance of that word. That's very, very... very much the opposite of what we're talking about today. To give an answer, apologia in Greek, an answer, is to give a reasoned argument to defend a position that you believe. Not because you're embarrassed of it, because you firmly are committed to it. And you have someone who has objected to it, and you have an answer for them in order that you might persuade them to leave their former position and to adopt yours. That's what we mean by apologetics. Now, the role of apologetics in evangelism, the role of apologetics for Christians, is something I'm going to ask you to put on the back burner, because I really like to spend a little bit of time tomorrow afternoon as we kind of bring all the threads together, and I'd like to explain how that can be helpful and its limitations as well. But let me say up front that to me, the value of apologetics has more to do with Christians than it does with non-Christians. Now, there is a sense in which many people are seeking truth, and the Spirit of God is working in their lives, but they have some intellectual objection to the Christian faith. And if you can clear away those objections for them and get them to see that what you believe is rational and comports with history, then they may be able to move forward and accept their responsibility before God and to repent and to believe the gospel. That is true. At the same time, no matter how many clever arguments you have and how persuasive your style, if you're dealing with an unregenerate person who does not seek God, who is not under conviction of sin, no amount of your arguing will ever convince that person to be a Christian. So you're wasting your time. That person does not have an intellectual deficit. He or she has a moral and spiritual deficit. And the reason he won't accept your arguments is not because they're not plausible, but because they require him to submit to an all-powerful God who holds him accountable for his sins and to whom he must answer after his life is over. And he's not willing to accept those things. He will live in giant denial, and therefore he will deny your claims and your arguments. But to a Christian who already believes, and of course every true believer is a believer from the time of salvation to the end of his life and on into eternity and forever. But there's such a thing as greater faith and lesser faith. There's such a thing as weak faith and even sick faith. And on the other hand, there's such a thing as strengthened and thriving and vibrant faith. And we want that kind of faith. And that kind of faith comes from the Word of God. It also comes from looking at things that show us the wonders of that word and its truth and its way of explaining reality, its way of addressing all of our great big questions like where did we come from and is there meaning in our lives and to whom are we responsible and where are we going. These things, once they're answered satisfactorily, are wonderfully upbuilding for our faith. So really, the fact that this room isn't full of unbelievers and skeptics is not a problem for us speakers, because we're really here to speak to you and to ourselves and to give an intellectual, yes, but maybe more importantly, a biblical and spiritual basis for what we believe. So I've taken the topic of the Bible and science, and I'll defend why I have done that in a moment, and then we'll move on to talk about the Word of God itself and its veracity, we say, its truthfulness, its claims, its infallibility, its inerrancy. And we'll talk about what all those terms mean. Andrew's responsible for that this afternoon, and then tomorrow David is going to take up the person of Christ and the nature of the atonement. And if we walk away with a firmer understanding of those things, we'll be in very good shape, and the Spirit of God can use this truth, I know, in our lives. Now, the reason I've decided to take up the Bible and science is because I think this is the area where Christians feel the most threatened and embarrassed in public education, higher education, and even in the workplace. You can believe many things and still be held as a reasonably intelligent, with it person. But if people discover you're a young earth creationist, you will be laughed off the stage. And out of a sense of deep embarrassment that this is such an anti-intellectual position because of the snow job that has been done by the establishment, the Ponzi scheme, which I'm going to argue is the way that they advance this truth, we have become intimidated. And I think it's time to stop being intimidated and realize that what we believe about origins makes eminent sense and comports much better with the data that are available than any of the scientific theories that are advanced under the general heading evolutionism. Notice I put that suffix ism on the end of evolutionism. And the reason I'm going to do that, it's a little bit obnoxious, I'm sorry, but we will grapple with this idea that evolution itself is a perfectly respectable word. And every good Christian should believe in evolution. And that may surprise you to hear me say that. That's the technique. We call that a speaker's technique to keep you awake, maybe even on edge. But what we don't believe in is evolutionism, which is a philosophy, a materialist philosophy, an anti-God position, which seeks to push God out of his universe and deny his existence and say that everything from molecules to man, from bacteria to Beethoven, came about by chance and by nothing else, purposeless, aimless, meaningless, and therefore I get to do whatever I want. So with that introduction, I would like to actually read the first chapter of Genesis together. I'd like to speak for a few minutes about some topics about evolution and creation, about the Bible and science in general, and then we will have a Bible reading on this first chapter of Genesis. Now, just a disclaimer here, I am actually reading out of the New King James Version. This was not approved by the elders, I'm sorry. I trust this won't be too much of a problem. It's not any intent to make any changes or to enforce an agenda. It's simply that I traveled light. I don't have the King James Bible with me. I have the New King James. The wording is very similar, a little bit of updating of the language. So here we go. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so.
And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light on the earth. And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the sea, and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth, and every tree, whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. A summary statement then, bringing to a close the seventh day. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from his work which God had created and made. And I would put the division then right there, rather than where the current divisions are in our Bibles. Now, I'm not going to say too much more about this chapter until we have the Bible reading part. Rather, I'd like to talk a little bit about this creation-evolution controversy and about the Bible and science in general. There have been scientists, I suppose, as long as there have been people. And in civilizations such as ancient Greece, there have been advances made in the natural world, in its understanding and how it works. But primarily, what we think of as modern science began in the 1500s in Europe. And it is a legacy of Christianity. It required Christian belief in order to put into place the very foundational ideas of science. For example, the universe is real. You would say, well, I've always known the universe is real. But interestingly, you may be surprised to learn that there are philosophies even in the world today that believe that reality is an illusion, ultimately, and there is no real world. Well, we can put those folks aside. They sound very strange to us. And yet, they do exist, and they did exist. But not when Christianity and what we would call the Judeo-Christian worldview became dominant in Europe, we realized we were dealing with a real universe. We realized that God and the universe were different. Many religions believe that in pantheism, which means is that God and the universe are the same. But Christianity said, no, the universe is a product made by God. And since God is rational, the universe is rational. And since God made us, we are rational. So if we apply rationality and our intellect to the orderly world that God has made with its fixed laws, we ought to be able to discover things that we can use to our advantage. This is really part of the creation mandate to subdue the earth. Now, subdue doesn't mean to subjugate and to tromp on or to abuse, but it means to put to good use and to put to expanded use the resources that God has given us. Science does that. Science was ruled over by a king and a queen. The king of science was theology. The queen of science was mathematics. You cannot do science without mathematics. Science cannot answer any questions that it does not measure. If it cannot measure and quantitate, it cannot answer. So math, and implied in that as well, is logical reasoning, are preconditions before you can do science. But I'm going to point out again that at the beginning, theology was the king of science. It was what gave science its very coherence and its very foundation. And also, it was recognized that the decrees of God and the truth of revelation were unassailably true, and that what men found through their finite senses, their limited faculties, their erroneous measurements, their faulty machinery and equipment, their fallible conclusions from their corrupt minds. In other words, I'm saying that there's pitfalls abounding in science that cause it constantly to need to be corrected because misperceptions are made all the time. It was understood that that was somehow lower than the truth that God gave in His Word. What we have today is something very strange. We have people who are standing on the shoulders of Johannes Kepler, who was a Bible-believing Christian who believed in a young earth and creation, Isaac Newton, Nicholas Copernicus, all Christian people, devout people. We could name many more of them. They're standing on their shoulders, but they're denying the very God that was the reason for science's birth to begin with. They're sawing off the limb that they're sitting on. They're robbing the Christian worldview of its foundation and using that for exploitative purposes while denying the very God who is the foundation of science. So that's a very interesting topic if you want to read more about that. The Biblical Basis of Modern Science by Henry Morris would be an excellent resource. But we'll move on. I just want to make that point that science began with Christianity. It was not only compatible with Christianity, it was considered to be inextricably linked with Christianity. It could not be there was no divorce in the minds of early scientists between revelation and reason. And of course, that sounds strange to us today when God has been thoroughly kicked out of the science classrooms of America. But that was not the way it was originally. There are two kinds of science, and we think about science as a way of trying to measure the physical world, to understand it, and to put it to practical uses. So we include science and engineering in this as well. There is something we call operational science, and then something we call forensic science, or we might also call it origins science, specifically when we're talking about the origins of the universe. What are the differences between the two? Well, operational science proceeds this way. You begin with observations. You then say, when you think about the observations and reflect on them for a little bit, I have some questions. Does sugar dissolve in water? Does the earth revolve around the sun? Is there an atmosphere on the moon? Okay, I have questions just based on my observations. And then what I have to do after I've formulated questions is I come down with what I think is the most likely answer. It's provisional, to be sure, but it's the most likely answer based on what I know right now. It's called an hypothesis. Then we set up experiments to try to prove or disprove that hypothesis. The hypothesis has to be something we can ask questions about that can be measured. It has to be something that can be perceived by the five senses or instruments that allow the five senses to go farther. Light microscopy can go 2000x. That's the limit of the light microscope. And we can't go much farther than that. But with a scanning electron microscope, we can go to 2 million X. So we can look at things that are exceedingly small. And the opposite would be true as well. Telescopes, of course, can go far out into the universe. So we have tools that enable our five senses to go farther than they themselves can go. But we gather these data, and we look at them, and we come down with either a confirmation or a refutation of our hypothesis, our pet hypothesis. This is one issue, of course. It might be a pet hypothesis. It's very hard to get rid of pets. And so scientists are people. They're human. They make mistakes. They have biases. And it's very important to realize that they are not different from you and me. In fact, there probably are some scientists in this room. I might even consider myself one. So we realize that this is a very fallible process by fallible people. So once a hypothesis has been generated and it has been tested and it seems to be true, we advance it to the next stage. We call it a theory. Now, very often at this point, we want to publish our theory. After all, we publish or perish in science, right? So we get it into a journal, and other people read it, and they either say, this is a wonderful insight, I think it's probably true, or they say, this is completely hokey, I have no reason whatsoever to trust this, this sounds ridiculous. And so those people in their laboratories repeat the process, and they're either going to be able to confirm or refute what we believe. If they confirm it, then of course we advance farther. We're more sure of our theory because it has been independently confirmed by more than one person in more than one place. And of course, theories that are especially strong and have especially stood up well can even be advanced to the highest tier of scientific inquiry, which is the law, like the law of gravity. But we've discovered that even things that enjoyed the privilege of being laws for a while ultimately turned out to be true, untrue, or at least not fully true. So even Newtonian mechanics, which we thought were obviously laws, the first, the second, and third laws of motion, have turned out to be slightly different than Newton thought, based on Einstein's special theory of relativity, for example. So nothing in science is ever 100% sure and can be known with absolute certainty. Even laws must be tentatively held. That doesn't mean we can't use them. We use them all the time. But in the end, we must understand that if a new piece of evidence comes forward that falsifies that law, it will have to be modified. Now, origin science is a very different thing. It certainly comes up with questions as well, but it has no way to measure them. Because what it is doing is it's looking historically at events that only occurred once. Did George Washington cross the Delaware? Well, today people would say, I'd like to get a scientific answer to that. That just shows how much of this hubris of science has permeated the world we live in. Who cares what scientists think about whether George Washington crossed the Delaware? That's a question for historians, not for scientists. Scientists can't speak to that. They have no way of going back there and reproducing the event. They have no way of going into a time warp and watching George Washington cross or not cross. They simply have to take the evidence that is provided by historians and accept or reject it, but science has nothing to do with such a question. And yet we have scientists now that want to go back to the beginning of time and tell us how things began, and to trace the steps from the beginning, even though they were not there, they were not able to measure it, they certainly won't be able to reproduce it in a laboratory, and yet we're to accept that to have the same strength as a scientific experiment that has been reproduced in a laboratory using modern equipment and confirmed at other centers throughout the world. These are two completely different animals. We know forensic science, of course, is used by the police forces and is very powerful. If you can pick up DNA evidence, for example, you might be able to show someone on death row is innocent and exonerate the person and he gets to walk. That would be a wonderful thing. We're glad when that happens. But we all know that even forensic science has its limits because everything is based on probability and on inferences. And we're talking about something that happened a year or two ago, not 15 billion years ago. So the assumptions we can make about 2013 are much more sure than the assumptions that we can make about 5 billion BCE, as they would say. Throwing Christ out, they want it to be BCE now. Okay, we're going to use BC in this room, okay, before Christ. So I want to make that distinction because when we're talking about evolution and the inquiry into the origin of the universe and the origin of life and the origin of man, the only thing science can say to it is questions can be asked, inferences can be drawn, assumptions can be made, but ultimately nothing can be known for sure because this is not part of operational science. It's basically historical reconstruction. Now, science has some limitations even in the laboratory. I'm just going to go through these quickly. I don't want this to be too boring. I realize it's already been somewhat boring. Such is the nature of the beast. So we plow on, all right? First is the inductive fallacy. You say, what's the inductive fallacy? This is a problem that every scientist has to face. We've already talked about it, but haven't used those terms. Let me set up a couple of examples. All swans are white. We observe swans. We've never seen anything but a white swan. We believe all swans are white. So we come up with this hypothesis, all swans are white. Then we go out into the field and examine it, gather more data, and finally we come to the conclusion this ought to be advanced to a theory, if not a law, because certainly there have been no exceptions. All cue balls hit by a billiard, all billiard balls hit by a cue, rather, I guess it's that order, move. Therefore, everything hit by a cue will move. Well, is that true? Well, you can go out and test those things, of course. You find out that the first one appears to be true in North America anyway. All swans are white, but it wouldn't take very much scientific endeavor to figure out that not all things will move when hit by a cue ball, right? Or not a cue ball, by a cue. I'll throw that example out. We're going back to the swans. So then we get a wonderful opportunity to travel to Australia. And we fly to Australia, and we're in great wonderment over the flora and fauna of that country down under. And the first thing we see in the park in Sydney is a black swan. We realize that our theory has got to be modified. In fact, it has to be thrown out. Not all swans are white. There are black swans. And here's the inductive fallacy, and all scientists who are thinkers have admitted this. Even B.F. Skinner and people like Bertrand Russell have been very candid about this. In inductive reasoning, you can never come to an absolute conclusion because you can never see all of the data. You're only able to sample a small part of it. And if in that data set all the swans are white, that might be a truth that you think you can hang your hat on. But you can never examine all the data. Who's the only one who can examine every piece of data through all the stretches of time in every location of the universe? God. And only God. God was there at the beginning. God saw it happen. God made it happen. God gave infallible witness to what happened. God wrote it down for us. We have an eyewitness account of someone who cannot lie. That's as good as historians can get. And we don't have any scientists who were there who could measure it. Now, we move on. There is also what we could call the deductive fallacy, and that is this. Deductions, which are used using logic to work from a theory and to work out its details, to say if A is true, then B and C might be true. There's always the problem that the theory that we're working from could be wrong, and we've explored why that could be. So whether they're inducing, that is, they're going from the specific to the general, or they're deducing, they're going from the general then to the specific, science can never give absolute answers. Any scientist would admit that. And so the only absolute answers we can get come from the infallible God. That is one take-home message from this weekend, all right? That applies to Andrew's meeting and David's meeting, maybe even more than mine, but it certainly applies to mine as well. Having talked a little bit about science in general, its Christian origins, the fact that it is fallible because it's practiced by fallible people, and that only God is infallible, let us talk for a little bit about the creation-evolution controversy for a few minutes, specifically. The first thing I want to say is that evolution is true. Did you all hear me? But evolutionism is false. Now, here's what I mean. Evolution can mean basically three things. For an individual person, the product, the son or daughter of parents, there has been a rearrangement of the genetic material of the mother and the father to produce you, a unique individual. You are different from them. In a sense, we have seen the genetic material evolve into a new form, you. Is that evolution? Well, most people who speak of such a process don't call it that, but it is change in a certain direction. And it has a reason, and it has an outcome, and therefore we would think that's a very valid, obvious example of evolution. But evolution isn't used that way very often. What it's used mainly of is the variations within a species or a kind of animal or plant. So these animals share what's called a gene pool, right? And all the animals would have two copies if they are diploid animals, which most are, and they have two copies of each gene. So any given gene, whether it's the gene for you know, that when it's defective causes sickle cell disease, or when it's defective causes cystic fibrosis. You know, you have two copies of these genes, and for some diseases, only one has to be defective for you to become ill. In other cases, both have to be defective for you to become ill. But throughout the population, all of us have two copies. And yet there are many variations of these. And so when something happens to stress the population, when a new antibiotic comes into a swill of bacteria, the ones that are able to resist that bacteria have a selective advantage, and they will begin to grow while the others will decline. You can see this in Darwin's finches. You can see this in the peppered moths. This is called microevolution. It is absolutely true. It is wise, and it is the product of a divine mind, which allowed the creation that he had made to rebound from stresses imposed on it and to adapt itself to its environment so that those who were most fit would survive and those who were less fit would have a disadvantage and would be either die off or would become very much a minority concern in the population. Most of what you hear about as evolution, most of what is written as proofs of evolution, most of the real-life examples of evolution that are provided to you in the classroom fit into this horizontal change paradigm, okay? So we're talking about existing species with existing genes, a finite, defined gene pool, and the rearrangement of that gene pool in individuals, making this trait more common and this one less common because of selective pressure. This is all true, and it's all wise, and it's all God. This has always been going on. And this is something we ought to be very thankful for, and it is something that we utilize all the time. Plant breeders accelerate this process, and I would say distort it a little bit, and so do animal breeders. They're working within a gene pool. They cannot create new genetic material, but they can manipulate the genetic material they have in the dog so that they can create more hair or less hair, more height, less height, a dog that points or a dog that chases, a dog that grabs prey, a dog that doesn't grab the prey, a dog that chews it up, and a dog that doesn't. Whatever they want to breed into it, they can do that. Now, when humans get involved, they mess things up, though, right? So animals that are left to breed themselves in nature become stronger and stronger. People who want traits that are not necessarily good for the animal create specimens that are weaker and weaker. That's why when you want to raise beef cattle, you don't raise purebreds. You hybridize. You take an Angus bull and you breed it with a Hereford cow and you get a non-pure cross, we call it heterosis, which is going to have more strength and is going to grow faster and is going to be less ill than the purebred because it has not been manipulated by people. But enough said. This is microevolution. These are horizontal changes. They are workings within a gene pool that already existed, created by God, and this happens all the time. Now, here's where the giant leap comes from. We've talked about individual people having evolved from their ancestors. We've talked about populations of people or dogs or plants that change over time based on changes in gene frequency in the population. Okay, so far so good. Now we're going to take the giant leap into the abyss. And we're going to say that because there can be variation within a species, that one species can turn into another species. And to do so, that first species can acquire, magically, new genetic material. From where? We don't know. And they can become higher and more complex so that lower forms, given enough time, and we're talking deep time here, billions of years, can slowly but surely climb the ladder, acquiring more and more genetic material, turning themselves into creatures that are very, very different from their ancestors. And therefore, the whole tree of life springs up from a single cell. So as I said before, molecules at the beginning, all the way to man. Or if you will, bacteria to Beethoven. All right? That kind of molecules to man evolution is a vertical change. It's what's called macroevolution, and it is wrong. It's never been observed to occur in the laboratory. It cannot be proven from the fossil record. It makes no sense based on the laws of thermodynamics, which we'll discuss briefly. Therefore, it can be categorically rejected. That is the Ponzi scheme. Now, you know Bernard Madoff made off with about $50 billion. And Bernard Madoff is the Ponzi man, okay? Although Ponzi was the first Ponzi man, I suppose. I doubt he was, actually. This is a pretty brilliant idea. I'm sure somebody thought of this many centuries ago. In a Ponzi scheme, what you have to do is you've got to just convince the next people below you of the truth of what you're saying, even though the people above you know it's not true, so that you can get more and more converts and, frankly, more and more money. And we have an intellectual establishment in this country controlled by the prince of the power of the air. And don't think I'm a conspiratorialist in every sense, but I am in this sense. This is an orchestrated effort to put God out of existence, or at least make him irrelevant. It is an orchestrated effort to intimidate Christians and to make them seem like fools. It's a way to get power and money for the establishment, allowing them to become enriched, to gain more control over education and therefore over the people, and ultimately to triumph in that sense and to enjoy lavish and debauched lives. Now, I'm not suggesting by such a cynical statement that all scientists are like that, but the thinkers among them have said, and they've said it clearly, that their reason to throw God out and to reject creationism, the reason they embraced Darwinism so enthusiastically, was because it allowed them to have the sexual freedom that they wanted. You can read it in their writings, Aldous Huxley, Julian Huxley, others. So they don't want to be accountable to God, they don't want God's morality, and this is a way for them to escape it. Now, when you're talking about something that ultimately has no substance, that cannot be proven, that is based on whims and presuppositions, you're talking about a Ponzi scheme. You're talking about something that is ultimately deceptive. And yet it has worked its way through higher education so that all of us now feel cowed and intimidated if we come into a classroom and say we believe God created the heavens and the earth in 6 literal days. That that's what we do believe. And therefore, we need to understand that this, to change the metaphor, the emperor has no clothes. And we're going to call him naked because he's naked. Macroevolution is not true. Microevolution is wonderfully true. That's why we need to be very clear on this point. This is what linguists or philosophers call equivocation. If you have one word and it can mean two things, and it's convenient to take the two meanings and blend them together so that the weak position is strengthened by the strong one, that's what you do. And our job is to dissect them and say, no, they're two different things entirely, and we believe this one and we reject that one. So no new genetic material has ever been made, and there's no mechanism by which to make it. I'm going to put the accelerator on. There's so many things we could say, but we want to spend most of this time in Bible study. I want to talk about observations from the past, as well as the fact that we have lack of evidence in current laboratory conditions. Let me start that one over. This is a better way to put it. You go to the evolutionist and you say, okay, you believe in macroevolution, you believe that molecules turned into man, you believe that things go higher and higher and acquire new genetic material and can become transformationally different from their ancestors. Show it to me. Prove it. Show me. And the evolutionist says, okay, well, we'll have a look. We'll go to the laboratory. We'll show it to you there. So he says, look, see these fruit flies? We bombard them with ionizing radiation, and they lose their wings. That's proof that mutations cause evolution. Well, you say a couple of things here. First of all, in what sense is that fruit fly advanced in its abilities and function by losing its wings? Probably not very much. Number two, you're working within a genetic pool that you have not increased or improved. You're talking about microevolution, not macro. I asked you for proof of macroevolution, speciation. So let's get out of the laboratory, unless you can show me something in the laboratory. And he goes, well, no. Speciation works far too slowly to see it in the laboratory. So you say, okay, you can't see it in the laboratory. All you see there is microevolutionary horizontal changes. No vertical changes. No improvement. No development of one species from another. No magic formation of new genetic material. So where do you have evidence for this? Ah, the fossil record. So then we're going to geology, all right? So we go to the geological formations of the Earth, and we find out that there are basically two types of rock out there. There's three types, actually, but we'll talk about two here. Igneous rock. This is like granite and feldspar and basalt. And this is all completely free of fossils. There are no fossils in such rocks. The other major type of rock was laid down by flooding. It's called sedimentary rock. This would include
limestone, sandstone, and shale, and coal as well, although that's not truly a rock. Now, these things are full of fossils. So we look at those fossils, and what we discover is that we have the sudden appearance of fully formed and functional species. Some of them are now extinct, but at the time they lived, they were fully formed and fully functional. They show no evolutionary change from one kind to another that is not highly questionable. It looks very neat on the pages of a biology textbook, but in reality, this horse series and the whale series and so forth are figments of imagination and can be openly refuted. So we stay with the rocks and the fossil record, and we realize that in that fossil record, we have the sudden appearance of species fully formed. They show little or no variation, and they either persist to the present or they go out of existence. They go become extinct. So you say, where's the speciation in that? Well, they say, you know, it happened too fast to see it there. Well, wait a minute. You said it was too slow to see it in the laboratory. And now we're out here in the rocks, and you're saying it's too fast to see it here. Oh, you know, it was too fast. This is what Richard Goldschmidt used to call the hopeful monsters, or this is saltationism, or punctuated equilibrium, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge. Those of you who have been in school recognize these people and these ideas. And this is that, for the most part, species remain very, very stable and static through all these years. But just because the Earth's magnetic field may have switched or there was a big influx of ionizing radiation or some catastrophe happened in a very brief period of time, there was a sudden flurry of evolution. And then everything came to a new equilibrium, so punctuated equilibrium. Now, since the punctuations are such short periods of time and the equilibrium things are such long periods of time, of course, all the fossils that you're going to see by chance are likely to be those from the equilibrium state, so they're going to not show evolution. The evolution occurred in the places you can't see it. So I'm saying, okay, this is advancing some field of knowledge by the lack of evidence. We have no evidence for this in the laboratory. We have no evidence for it in the rock formations. So where do you see it? The answer is you don't. It's a Ponzi scheme. Now, if I sound very dismissive or very cynical or very, I realize this is a friendly environment. I'm preaching to the choir. I'm carrying coals to Newcastle, as they say. But I'm serious about what I'm saying, and I think it's important that we remain intellectually rigorous and do not use the kinds of faulty arguments the other side uses. But at the end of the day, what I have said is true, and therefore, it's a Ponzi scheme, okay? We move on. Just briefly here. Deductions from the laws of science, I want to say a couple of things. They say that the universe came into existence out of nothing. This violates the first law of thermodynamics, that is the conservation of energy and matter. The law simply states that energy, or as we know from E equals MC squared, energy and matter are interconvertible. So mass energy can neither be created or destroyed. That is to say, there is no such thing as an effect without a cause. So we say, give us that again. Run that by us again. How did the universe begin? Well, at a period of time, around 15 billion years ago, there was a sudden explosion, and nothing generated something. And the universe exploded into being. So we say, okay, if it exploded into being, what was it before it was being? And they say, well, if it wasn't being, I suppose it was non-being. That's good. So it was non-being. So if it was non-being, what's another word for non-being? Another word for non-being is nothing. All right? And I didn't need to come all the way from Michigan to tell you folks, nothing can't explode. Okay? This is the folly. Professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. There was a debate I was watching where William Lane Craig was debating Peter Atkins. When I was in physical chemistry, I used Peter Atkins' textbook. But Peter Atkins left academic chemistry to become an atheist. He's not one of the good ones, by the way. He's a bad debater. So when William Lane Craig had him painted into the corner very nicely, he said, well, at the end of the day, nothing exists. Because all reality is the separation of positive and negative charges.
And if they were allowed to implode back on each other, you would have nothing. This takes a PhD, okay? You have to have tenure to be this good, okay? This is the folly of people who have rejected the clear revelation of Scripture. They do become fools. And again, this is potentially an ad hominem argument, calling someone who's you disagree with a fool. I'm saying his arguments are foolish, all right? The man may be brilliant. This is one of the problems with our folks in school, is these people are smart. They are well-educated. They are intimidating in that way. You feel that you're intellectually far the inferior of these people. So you let them intimidate you. And you shouldn't do that, because the truth is on your side and the truth will prevail. Another point to be made quickly, and I will stop at the hour, will I? Okay, I will. Is that evolution cannot be true, not only because it doesn't exist in the laboratory, not only because it cannot be proven from the fossil record, not only because it breaks the first law of thermodynamics, but because it breaks the second law as well. The second law says that no process can be fully efficient. Therefore, the effect cannot be greater than the cause. Everything that requires energy will release some of that energy in a useless form called heat. So on a hot summer's day, you're in your kitchen. You say, boy, it's hot in here. I think I'll open the refrigerator door. That will cool the room down. Will it? No, it will heat the room up. Because now your compressor is going to be running nonstop because the door is open. And the amount of cooling that occurs inside the refrigerator must, by the second law of thermodynamics, be less than the amount of heat generated by the compressor. So the net gain in temperature will be positive, and the kitchen will heat up. That's the way life is. Nothing can be fully efficient. Therefore, things that are effects cannot be greater in complexity than their causes in a closed system. Now, I grew up from a little boy to a man, and people put together 747s out of 4.5 million non-flying parts. So that seems to be against entropy, but it isn't, because that's a closed system. And the amount of energy it took to make me grow up or to put together the plane was more than counterbalanced by a waste of energy and, of course, the generation of heat, which is random molecular motion. And, of course, the whole universe is going toward a heat death. And over billions of years of time, the universe will be motionless, and it will be at 4 degrees Kelvin, according to predictions, and nothing will happen. Everything will be random motion. That's the apocalypse, I suppose, of the evolutionist. Not very apocalyptic, but it's certainly the end of what they see the world being. So, therefore, to have complex organisms arise out of less complex organisms breaks that law. I'm going to save some of these other things for our Bible reading, which will begin momentarily. I just want to talk for a minute, though, about some of the consequences of evolution beyond the fact that it has co-opted science. Racism existed before Darwin. Darwin made racism respectable. Not so much today, because there's a giant attempt to push it back and to distance themselves from it. But we know the eugenics movement. We know Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger. We know that Adolf Hitler and the attempt to eliminate Jews and gypsies and black people all were based on Darwinian thinking. That was the scientific underpinning of something that existed before but had now been made respectable because it was scientific. And the purges and the tremendous iniquity of the 20th century under people like Pol Pot and the killing fields and Mao and Hitler and, of course, Lenin and Stalin, all of whom were evolutionists, all of whom were Darwinians, shows that this kind of theory, whether it be true or not, and it's not, will produce nefarious things in society. Now, people, as I say, are attempting to backpedal from that, but what was the origin of Darwin's, what was the title of Darwin's book? The Origin of Species, which is the thing he did not show, by the way. He did not show that. So the title of his book is false. He did not show that. He shows everything but that in the book. He did not show the origin of species by natural selection, which is a tautology, or the development of the favored races. That's the subtitle of the book. This leads, of course, to the cheapening of human life, because a boy is a bat
is a dog, is a cat. This is the kind of, this is a quote, believe it or not, saying that there is no superiority to human beings. We're just animals after all. We can behave like animals and we can kill each other like animals. We have no inherent value. We have no meaning. It doesn't matter if we're germs. If the white germs want the black germs to sit on the back of the bus, who's to say that's wrong? Because this is all meaningless. We have no value. We have no personal human value, if this be true. At the same time, paradoxically, when God is pushed out, the human being fills the void of the deity. And we have people now worshiping themselves. Self-worship and the entirely solipsistic type of self-pleasing, self-centered mindset that is so common today, far more than historically, although people have always been meists, far more today, is clearly a product of this as well. I'm thinking about the selfie. I'm thinking about people taking selfies. Well, that's partly because they have cameras that can do that. But why would people want to take pictures of themselves? Because they're interested in themselves more than they are other people, right? They want to broadcast themselves on YouTube. They want to, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm not against technology. I'm just saying this entirely self-centered atmosphere that we live in certainly would be a product of evolution as well. I'm going to stop at this point. I went quite long, but I think that such is the nature of this discussion. I'd like to take a break for about 10 minutes. I hope that what I've done is actually provoke some thought in this first part that we can flesh out and talk about more in the second part. I'd like now to move to a discussion of Genesis chapter 1, but I'd like to give you about 5 minutes, okay, to stretch and reconvene, and we'll reconfigure up here. I'd like to introduce to you as well, not David Peterson, he's well known to you, but my brother Andrew Robertson from Chatham, Ontario, who's kindly agreed to come along and help us this weekend. Some of you know him from conferences in other places, but if you don't know him, he's a wonderful man, and we're glad he's here. So, with that, you are now dismissed until we reconvene at about 10 after.